net tonight at 8 o'clock.
Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And my name is Dick. It's time we begin the TechNet as we've done for 35 and a half years, starting in September of 1982. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. Amateurs who are curious about wireless products, ham radio products in particular, gather here and teach each other. Apprenticeship is the best way of learning things. This is a kind of an apprenticeship, so to speak. The people who sign in have all kinds of history or experience in many areas of wireless equipment, and you hear them discussing it. Occasionally you'll hear things that are a little too complicated for you. Let me drop them. You may occasionally hear things that are a little bit too complicated for you. And if you think about it real hard, you realize that whenever you're learning new information, something you haven't had experience with before, it's going to be uncomfortable. You're going to be hearing vocabulary and phrasing that you've never heard before. Don't let that discourage you. Sit and listen, and eventually it'll start to make some sense. There are people who can learn a foreign language by just listening to people talking, if you know what I mean. So, when it comes to the questions that are appropriate for the technical net, it's usually any question of interest to radio amateurs. Obviously, a lot of that has got to do with transmitters, receivers, antennas, transmission lines, propagation, the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. But ham radio operators are kind of person that really has a scientist inside trying to get out, in my opinion. So they're also quite often interested in astronomy and physics and science. That's the reason why we've now added a physics and science section along with a space section. Amateurs also like to keep track of what's going on with National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And Paul WS2N supplies that. And Roy AC2GS supplies the science and physics section. He will be giving a science and physics talk tonight, number 22. Let me drop. Paul WS2N will be giving a space report, number 292. And I will try to act as moderator for the first section of the TechNet, where this is TechNet number 1692, starting in September of 1982, 35 years ago. We believe that this net represents a bit of a record breaker as far as the total number of years under one, essentially under one leadership, and the total number of hours. If you go to http://, you don't have to put www, but you then put amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, you'll be looking at the website set up by Mike, number one, KC2NJI, where the last 10 years, or the 12 years, I think it's 12 years, the last 12 years of the TechNet, of the 35 years, are recorded. You can choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and play them back. So people who are unable to stay up as late as we go, this TechNet lasts usually until midnight, 4 hours from now. Let me drop. And for the people who can't stay up that late, what they can do is go to that website a couple of days downrange and download this particular TechNet or a previous one, and then people will play it as they're commuting to work or on their lunch hour or whatever, if they're unable to stay up as late as well. Okay, a person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or comment. By first waiting for the four beeps, then giving us his call letters and his name. Lots of people keep forgetting me to give me their name because I'm kind of forgetful and I like to refer to people by their name. And then the word yes. The word yes means you do have a question or a comment. You have something you want to say to the group on the TechNet. You need not sign in because you're listening. A great big long list of people saying I'm listening doesn't really tell us very much. After 35 years, we have reason to believe somebody is listening. Let me drop. And the TechNet also has the two other kinds of connection, at least, maybe three. IRLP, Echo Link, Chat Room. So there's people from time to time signing in and or listening from out of state and out of country. This particular repeater has moderately good coverage of northern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Connecticut, most of Long Island. But by way of those other modes, Echolink and IRLP, it has range that goes much further. So at this time, for people who do have a question or a comment, please give me, wait for the four beeps, give me your call letters and your name, and the word yes right now, K2RIW listening. My name is Dick.
W-H-O-R-I-Y, Joe, yes.
K-A-2-G-E-S, the name is Bob, and it's yes.
Okay, we got a slightly noisy Joe, R-I-Y, and then Bob is a K-A-2 Golf Echo Foxtrot. Is that correct, Bob?
Yes, that's correct, Golf Echo Foxtrot.
Okay, and I can hear you listening with a delay in the background. Okay, so we got Joe and Bob. Anyone else to sign in who does have a question or comment, give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
KD2MBB, the name is Pulse Bob. Yes.
Okay, was that Kilo Echo 2, Mike Bravo Bravo? Is that your call letters, Bob? Go ahead.
That is Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo.
Okay, Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo. Seems like I made the same mistake last week. Alrighty. We got Joe, Bob number one, and Bob number two. Anyone else who does have a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we probably have more than enough to get going, and if someone signs in late, that's possible. Joe, you were a little bit noisy on that last transmission. WA2 Romeo Yankee Yankee, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
How's this, Mo? A little better? A little louder for you? Okay, copyable?
You're now 95% full quieting. Go ahead.
Very good. Okay, good evening, Vic. W-H-O-R-Y here. I was doing some experiments with my one of my TV converters and doing a signal measurement again, being that I know that some of the transmitters in New York City are moving to the World Trade Center. And I can see that from making measurements with a spectrum analyzer as far as their, you know, signal level I knew before to what it is now, which increased from 8 to 10 decibels. Well, what I did this time was I put about 47 decibels of worth of attenuation in front of the converter, and I want to see, in fact, that's all I had, I want to see what channels I could still get out of New York City. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. With the three UHF channels, which are the strong, which is 30, 31, 33, I think even 36. 31, 33, and 36 are the strongest ones now. They come in about minus 45 approximately, if I look at that carrier at the bottom end of the band. I use it for reference level. And the transmitter on RF3, WJLP, comes in about almost about a minus 40. So that's about the absolute strongest one. Here's what's interesting. After I put the padding in front of the converter, I was still able to get those three channels with that much padding in front, and it made the converter signal go from the indicator from way up on the good, I'd say an estimated about 95% from on the bar. Let me see where it resets. I think in the highest it goes about probably 95% of the strongest I've ever seen. Never completely goes right to the end, but very close to it. That went down to about mid-scale or 50% when I put that much padding in. So I was still able to see the signal and still get a reasonable indication on the bar graph, which I, from what I understand now, equals signal, not signal strength, but actually bit arrays measuring approximately. The funny thing about RF channel 3 was it was going around, say, 70, 60 to like 70, maybe 80%, up and down and up and down without the padding. And I put the padding in, it did not change that relative level. It still did the same thing, where the other channels are pretty much pinned right to the end. Can you explain this? WA to Roy Wide.
I think I can. Channel 3, let's see now, 54, 60, 60 to 66 megacycles. That's down in the lower VHF region, where at 70 megacycle region, you've got a number of commercial stations, and you probably have a number of two-way radio frequencies in the vicinity. So therefore, with no padding, a strong signal 5, 10, 15 megacycles away can create a couple of dB of compression of your preamplifier. What happens with a amplifier that goes into compression on any one frequency and loses X number of dB of gain because of compression, it has the exact same amount of compression with a small variation on all other frequencies. So your preamplifier can lose, let me pick a number, 5 dB of gain because it's gone into 5 dB of compression because of a strong local signal. With the pad in front of it, you no longer are putting it into the compression region, therefore its gain is constant, therefore you're not seeing it going up and down. That's a guess. Also, where you said that some of those stations were like 45 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, you seem to have estimated, and you're putting in 47 dB of loss, that would suggest you're going into negative numbers and the converter shouldn't be working. Let me drop it.
Let me correct you. I didn't say 45 dB of, 45, I should have said correctly, 45 dBm as measured on a 75 ohm cable into a 50 ohm impedance with spectrum analyzer. So the reading could be slightly off, but very slightly. 45 dBm and RF channel 3 was about minus 40 dBm. Okay? I can't measure bit error rate or anything else like that. I probably should have specified that earlier. And I'm looking at this through a TV antenna with a mass finder preamp, and I'm putting the padding ahead of the converter. I'm not touching the amplifier up on the TV antenna at the top. I can't do that.
Okay, but still, the converter up top, the preamplifier up top, is giving you X number of dB of gain. That means, assuming it's got the right bandwidth, out of frequency region signals, out of band, so to speak, still come through that preamplifier. It may not be the first thing that goes into limiting. The first stage or second stage of gain in your converter down below goes into limiting, is a guess. And it still has the effect that I just described. So the fact that the signal is going, the apparent signal goes up and down with no padding, and with padding the signal no longer goes up and down, out of frequency region signals are a good explanation. If you had a directional coupler on that cable coming down so that you could sample the signal into your spectrum analyzer and then look across that frequency region, I think you're going to see a correlation between when the gain goes up and down and when a strong signal nearby comes and goes. That's a suggestion as to what you could try to see if you can get a confirmation of my hypothesis here, Joe. W2RYY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Jesus.
Oh, you talked about somebody with a noisy signal. Yeah, I heard you, Eric. Well, I can do that because I actually, at one converter location, I have two coax lines coming up from the basement. One is a converter, and the other one is just a line that you keep a terminator on, but I can take that and put that into my spectrum analyzer. And they both give me the same reading, so both lines have the same loss off the four-port splitter in the basement, which is being fed from the TV antenna system up top. I don't really have any out-of-band signals that are that terribly strong. The amplifier also has a FM notch built into it, which I have turned on, which tends to try to limit FM broadcast signals coming through. Otherwise, they would be killing me. They are strong, but it does try to limit them somewhat. That's some additional information for you. But if you're talking about like two-way radio being operated in the nearby vicinity, this signal level, the effect I saw with the converter didn't change. It wasn't like it was good, then it went bad, then it went good again. I'll talk about this type of effect I've noticed for quite a while, on especially RF channel 3, where it goes around between, say, 60 or 75 to like 85% as far as what the binary rate on the what it displays on the actual bar graph. And the other ones on UHF are all up around 90, 95% now that they move from one point to another. Back to you.
When the bit error rate changes, does it do it sort of abruptly, like with a square wave pattern, 5 seconds on, 10 seconds off, something like that? Joe, go ahead.
No, not really. It just seems to just vary over maybe 10 seconds, 5 to 10 second span. It'll go higher, then it'll go lower. It just seems to like wander back and forth, like it's nothing. Like nothing out of band is making it do that at that kind of rhythm, you know. It's a fairly constant rhythm that I'm seeing. And I do know that if I try to look at the next adjacent channel on either way, channel 4, which is 66 to 72, or channel 2, which is 54 to 60, I do see high noise level interference. Because those two TV channels I can't get unless I get a tremendous band opening. So I do have a lot of local line noise that's being picked up from the antenna on those other channels because they don't have anywhere near the signal strength that RF channel 3 does. I'm just wondering maybe if that like is like underlying underneath channel 3 and making the bit error rate jump up and down like that. But it's funny it only does it on low band. I've seen it on higher frequencies also, but maybe not as much as pronounced as a low band. Let Eric put his 2 cents and see what he's got to say about this.
You've got it, Eric.
First of all, can you hear me?
You're 50% audio, 50% noise. We hear every word. Go ahead, Eric.
I'm wondering why I'm getting noise. I just left the cell and I just changed the voice shift in there, so it speaks English. There are a couple of things to this. Now, you're talking strictly about low band, okay? You know, channel 3 is coming off of, four times square. Not everybody has moved to the World Trade Center yet, although Channel 2 is ready, they have not on the air yet. Let's see, 13's ready, but there's no antenna ready for them. But, as far as the preamp goes, any little bit of compression will actually create the kind of distortion that you really won't see on a spectrum analyzer, but if you were looking at it from a digital point of view, you'll find that the eyes will start to close on you. What happens is that as it goes into that compression, the linearity of the amplifier changes, and that creates problems. But as far as like a signal causing compression up and down, although he did say he's got the FM notch on, there are a number of different services that are well within the broadcast band, you know, channels 14, 15, 16, 17. Which is generally pretty strong. I know there's some stuff out east, there's some stuff around Central Nassau that is rather periodic in its transmission because it's digital. And if you don't know what you're looking for on the spectrum analyzer, you won't see it.
Now, for the first 30 seconds of that transmission, you were very noisy. When I switched over to Selden, you were full quieting. And I could tell you're transmitting into Selden and coming through Selden full quieting, but you were coming out of 8.5 kind of noisy for the first 30 seconds. Now, out of 8.5, you're dead full quieting, even though you're continuing to come from Selden. So I guess something strange happened with a voting system or a line driver. The UHF link from Selden to Glen Oaks maybe needed to warm up. And yes, what you said makes a lot of sense. And one of the guests I've got, Joe, which could be taking place, is that when you're watching Channel 3 RF with padding in there, you're seeing a real amount of propagation variation, signal getting stronger and weaker as it does all day long. If you run a strip shot recorder, you find that the signal is always changing in strength. Maybe numbers like peak to valley of 3 dB, but that changes the bit error rate. Without the padding, your signal is so strong that the bit error rate is 1 bit per 10 million, and therefore it could no longer see any significant change in bit error rate with a change in signal strength. That's another guess on my part. To B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Okay, again, I understand about propagation, but when I look at the spectrum analyzer, I don't see any variation of that carrier at 0.3094 below the bottom end of the band. I'm looking at that fairly precisely. Maybe I see a 1 decibel change, a little bit up and down, but it's fairly constant. It's not like, you know, like skip I'm looking at, where it goes up and down. And the bit error rate reading of the converter on channel 3 changes the same rate whether I have the padding in or I don't have the padding in front of the converter. Whereas a UHF goes down to 50% and stays at 50%, and if I take the padding out, it goes up to like 95%. That's the strange thing about this.
Well, what Eric said is that with other signals on the band coming on and off, you might not see intermodulation distortion, you might not see strong signals, but it still can be giving you changes in bit error rate of a digital signal, which is what your converter is trying to demodulate, this 8 VSB thing, which is quite vulnerable to multipath, minor changes in multipath, which is not easy for you to detect. I mean, if your signal on channel 3 is getting to you by two separate paths, and those two paths are at the threshold with the beating against each other, that could also give you some funny effects. Over to you, Joe, WDRYY, KQRIW.
All right, I have nothing more to add to this. This is just more or less a curiosity question, because I've never seen this. The last time I put the panning, I was really changing, just really trying to test UHF for performance. And with that, again, as I said, I only got 3 UHF channels. All the VHF channels were gone, except for channel 3. And I only got 3 UHF channels out of the city. So, you know. And Eric, I think you said channel 2 is moving to the Trade Center. I think they're on the Trade Center. I looked at shift 584 to 590 to 590, which is RF-33. They're much, much stronger, and they don't have the distorted pattern anymore. So I think they moved already.
Okay, we're going to turn it over to Eric, KE2EJ. And also, how come your signal was a little bit noisy for the first 30 seconds of your last transmission and then dead full quiet, even though you're continuously coming from Selden? KE2EJ, mobile, KQRIW in the TechNet. You got it, Eric.
WK2J. Oh, don't tell me I've got another problem. Now I'm just coming up to, it's 111 I'm going to be passing. I'm heading west again. There's a couple of things. I mean, if you had a scope that had the bandwidth, so you could actually see the signal instead of looking at it on a spectrum analyzer, if you saw it in the time domain, you would actually see a lot of stuff that you're not going to see in the frequency domain. Don't forget, the 8 VSB is AM modulated, so it's a funny transmission system. When, even when you get multipath, you might not notice that there's multipath there when looking at a spectrum analyzer. You may see a little wiggle, you may not. The kind of distortion that we're talking about coming from a free amp, let's say, you're not going to see it on a spectrum analyzer. You need to actually either look at it as in the time domain or through some demodulator that's giving you an accurate count of what's going on bitwise. Channel 2 at this point, I believe, and I could be wrong, I believe it's still on Empire. The last time I was up there, the transmitter's there, it's all set to go, but they haven't switched over. So, I could probably find out tomorrow whether or not they're operating from World Trade. But not everybody's moved yet, so the funny bend from the side mount antenna or the pillar antenna, I think that's been shut off. So I'm not absolutely sure what the story is, but I will find out. K4RW, K2J.
Yeah, don't worry, Eric. During that whole transmission, your signal-to-noise ratio coming directly out of Selden and coming directly out of Glen Oaks was identical and good sounding. So you sound good. It was only that previous transmission, the first 30 seconds, you were full quieting out of Selden and slightly noisy out of Glen Oaks. And maybe it was some kind of a voting characteristic of the RF link. Well, maybe the RF link doesn't have a vote. Maybe it's got a transmitter that needs to warm up. Okay. Good information about broadcast. So, too bad you don't have enough directivity of the antenna with your rotator, Eric. Maybe you do. There might be a very sharp notch somewhere in the antenna pattern where the main lobe is too broad, you can't do it. But with a sharp notch, you may be able to see the angular difference on that one frequency. There's the problem of World Trade Center versus Empire. And what's the real angular difference from your QTH of those two locations? You may be able to resolve where you think they're coming from. To B12YY, our broadcast experimenter, K2RIW. You got it, Joe.
Well, let me tell you that it's 0.8 of a degree from Plainview, the difference.
Are they side by side from your point of view, or are they almost in line from your point of view, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, you got to remember where I am. I put up a microwave link to World Trade. That's how I know what the difference is. It's the difference between the two digits. I got one that's pointing actually at 4 times square, and I've got another one that's pointing at WTC. And after tuning it, the actual difference is like point. It's a little bit less than 0.8 of a degree. But you got to remember, I'm a little bit north of the middle of the island, and I'm pretty much on the borderline between Suffolk and Nassau County, so that'll give you an idea.
You are quite far north on Long Island, whereas Joe is on the South Shore. You've got a mental map of where those broadcast centers are located. So from Joe's point of view, on the South Shore, do you believe the angular difference between those two locations is greater or lesser compared to you? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, my guess is it may be slightly less. It depends upon where he is on the South Shore. I mean, the island is only 25 miles wide at its widest point, and we're not even at that particular place, so I would probably say it's somewhere between 0.6 and 0.8 degrees where he is, which is not really significant.
Okay, Empire is further east than World Trade. World Trade is on the west side of Manhattan. Empire is close to the east side on Fifth Avenue. Therefore, there is the possibility, from your point of view, they are in line on the North Shore. From the South Shore, I think that angle between the two widens. From Joe's point of view, I think he's going to see a greater angular difference between Empire and World Trade. You see what I'm saying here? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, I see what you're saying, but, you know, what is significant? How much of an antenna? You've got a Yagi up there. You can't think of it as a narrow beam gain type of device. He would actually have a sharper lobe on UHF because there's more elements, although the resonances are a little closer together than, say, his antenna's got low band VHF, which is probably, I would say it's one element. Maybe two if you're lucky. So, that much difference in terms of the antenna movement, I don't think you're really going to see the difference. But I could be completely wrong.
Yeah, Dick, I can swing the antenna 10 degrees back and forth, and there's no amplitude difference of most of the UHF signals I see coming out of New York, especially them being on the Trade Center. I really just, the antenna's just not that sharp.
Yeah, both Eric and Joe are saying the same thing, and that's what I was saying, that from the main lobe beamwidth, which is probably 40 degrees wide, you cannot resolve Empire from World Trade. However, almost every antenna pattern has some extremely sharp null, where the null might be 1 degree wide. So there is the possibility of slightly rotating the antenna so you put one in the null or the other in the null. And so, null detecting of azimuth, if you can do it, can give you some very sharp information. If you're not getting a whole lot of local multipath that can hear the daylights out of the thing, making the bell go up and down in depth because of the change in the local multipath. So no DFing can be extremely sharp. The problem is, how do you know where the null is on the, say for instance, channel 3. If you find the null on channel 3 and then you go to channel 33, of course the whole damn pattern is going to be completely different. But you see what I'm saying here? Null detecting would allow you to see angular difference. W-A-2-L-Y-Y, T-2-I-W.
Let me add something.
You've got it, Eric.
You know, when you think of a single frequency in terms of the way we normally think with two-way radio, that's pretty much predictable in terms of what your antenna is going to do. When we start talking about something that is Nyquist filtered, it's a long story about that, but essentially you're taking noise and you're spreading it across the spectrum. Because you may think that you've got a null in one particular place at one specific frequency, it doesn't necessarily have to apply to the entire signal. You know, that null can be a rather narrow bandwidth. And again, you're talking about log periodic. You don't have that function of gains to make it really noticeable. You look on a spectrum analyzer all you want, you won't see anything. If you're actually doing the decoding, then you might actually notice it. So, you know, as a visual observation, I don't think you're going to see it.
Okay, I'm going to very much agree with more than half of what you said, Eric, and that is every television aerial is trying to cover, to some degree, channel 2 to channel 84 in the old days, lots and lots of spectrum. So most of those frequencies, the antenna, if you carefully measure it, it's azimuthal pattern. It's got peaks and valleys all over the place, all kinds of notches and peaks and valleys, side lobes all over the place. So at one particular frequency, like channel 2, you might be able to find a null in the pattern, which is 1 degree wide, and use it for direction finding. And so, unfortunately, now what is he going to use for a reference? The only way he could choose a reference is to go to some other channel, which you know is on World Trade, and then another channel that you know is on Empire. Unfortunately, the other channel on another frequency has an entirely different null pattern, so you can't use it. So on one frequency, he will resolve one angle versus the other with those nulls. But now to know, is the null aimed at Empire or aimed at World Trade, that's a very difficult thing to reference. And so you're right on that one. Although the information is there, you can't use it because you can't calibrate it. You see what I'm saying on this one, Joe? W-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the tech man.
I understand what you're talking about, but I'm trying to apply that to the original question I asked, which it doesn't really apply directly because, you know, RF3 is coming from, like you said, 4 times square. I believe that. That's lookable up information. The other stuff I know is just to come from the Empire, like RF-28 is coming from there, and I think maybe RF-7 is still coming from there or whatever. But there are three of them that give me the same signal strength. And I remember when originally when one transmitter moved over to the Trade Center, I got a significant increase in signal strength. Now I get three channels giving the same signal strength. They're all about minus 45. They used to be about minus 55 or 56 or 57. So I can see there's a significant difference between location 1 to location 2. Topography may have something to do with it also because the Empire building is midtown compared to me. There may be more stuff in the way compared to the Trade Center, which is more on the South Shore, which is a little flatter. So that is something else I've considered also, why the signal strength is better. But you can't argue. Well, ask yourself a question. You've been watching Channel 2 for a while. Have you seen the picture drop out like you used to drop out in the past? Same thing with Channel 9, which is now on RF-25. They're significantly different than what they were before, right? You see a difference? You are always complaining. playing on CBS and WWOR as far as signal drop out half the time through the daytime. You don't get that anymore, do you?
Hold on now. I get some terrible dropouts on, let me think which channels. Oh. All of a sudden I'm having trouble remembering which channels I get dropouts on. Channel 2 is not a heavy dropout channel. When I get co-channel interference on channel 2, yes, channel 2 gives me a lot of grief when there's a band opening. But channel 2, oh, wait a minute, I got a problem. That's what advertised as channel 2, which the real channel 2 slash channel 3, that comes out 33, I think it is, Joe, go ahead.
33 is 3.
Yeah, CBS is on RF-33, WWOR, Channel 9, used to be on RF-38, they're gone, that's off the air. They're now occupying whoever used to own what be on RF-25, and that signal strength is quite different. I don't think they're off the Trade Center from that location, but they moved buildings and from the Empire to this other building. Could be four times square, I don't know, but it's a significant difference. I don't get dropped out on them either. The funny thing is, when you look at the information, I guess you also looked at the information I sent you via email on that FCC website. In the future, WCBS is going to eventually get repacked to go over to RF-36, and so is WFSB at Hartford. So you'll still have the co-channel interference later on, if it will exist again.
Let me add something. If you're going to make a reference in terms of signal strength, you want to look at WNJU NBC. Now I forget what RF channel they're on. They're operating at almost a megawatt, whereas the other stations, ERPs, are more than less than half of that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
NJU is on RF-36. You're telling me that they're not the same, they're higher signal strength than RF-33 or RF-31, which I believe are also on the Trade Center. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The highest ERP coming out of New York City is NJU. They're almost a megawatt. How they got away with that, that's a long story. But it's significantly different than the other channels that are coming out of there.
Okay, well, I don't see that difference out here, really. It's kind of funny. I don't really see that. I'll make detailed measurements again with the analyzer when I get a chance, but that's about it for the subject, Dick. I have one other thing. You could probably consider this a space report question, or a question related to space. Do you know anything about a Meade telescope, M-E-A-D-E? Have you ever heard of the brand?
Very common.
Yeah, very common. It's named after Lake Mead. It's a California company. They're in competition with Celestron. Celestron and Mead. Celestron, I think, leads Mead, but Mead is a very popular Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. For instance, their 8-inch diameter Schmidt-Cassegrain is a very popular product. Over to you on that one, Joe.
Oh, you mean 8 inches as far as the lens size? What if the lens size is about 3 or 4 inches? Is that still halfway decent?
Meade and Celestron were going to have a merger about 4 years ago. And the FTC said that would be getting rid of all competition, and they negated that merger. But those two companies were going to join. Meade makes a whole lot of products. Celestron makes a whole lot of products. Almost nobody has any complaint of either of those companies. They've both been around for something like 20 years at least, Joe. So I don't think you can go wrong with either brand name. Go ahead.
Meade makes a lot more refractors than they do reflectors.
Okay. Go ahead, Joe.
I was just kind of curious because, you know, there was somebody on my block not very far away from me who was cleaning out the garage and put a Meade telescope out to the curb, and I got to it before the junk man got to it, so I have now have myself a telescope. Never could buy one, but I have one now.
How many inches is that forward lens, Joe?
I said it's about, it looks like a 3 or 4 inch diameter at the far end of a little tube. It's not 8 inch. It's about a 3-4 inch diameter lens, I would think. Look, that's just optically. That's what, just looking at the thing. I just briefly looked at it when I brought it inside. And it's also got some sort of other gizmo on it with a coil cord that has some sort of like auto finder or something like that. That may be for azimuth readings or something like that to maybe locate a star system or something like that. I'll play with it the next couple of days and put a battery in the thing and see if it works.
Sounds like a refractor. Oh, without a doubt, it's a refractor. Slim chance that it's a Maxitov reflector, but I think it's a reflector, like you said, 3 or 4 inches. That is that's $400 or $500 for the telescope there, Joe. You did very well. Did it come with eyepieces? And if not,
Repeater, time out.
Can you ask him if he's got other things that go with it? Over to you, Joe.
No, I wasn't going to ask the guy. He just, you know, just a local thing. But he put the thing on that thing, that mounted on a tripod. It had a cover on each end, on the eyepiece end, and the large lens end. And has a little compass that sits in one of the holes of the, goes on the tripod, just a little portable compass. But the thing with the cord was kind of interesting because it has some sort of auto finder thing on it. So I don't know, maybe this thing, if you put lat long coordinates in or something like that, maybe it can tell you angularly where you have to aim your telescope to look at a particular star. As I said, I'll try powering up the next day or so and see how it works. I'll give a report on it next week.
Yeah, once you've got the model number and you go to the MEAD website, you can download the owner's manual free of charge. Both Cushcraft, both the other brand name I can't think of right now, Star, both of them will give you a free manual. And that is probably a Starfinder. Once you line it up on the North Star, once you fix your tripod correctly, then that thing probably has a menu where you can say, where is the star Sirius? And it'll go zip, 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 and move its motors and go there. So you've got to find there. Where you told me it's got a lens cover over the eyepiece end, which implies it has an eyepiece, and the objective end, the wide end, sounds like you've got the complete machine, except for maybe some other accessories he had with it. That is one hell of a find. Why in the world would somebody like put that out on the garbage? He must be bailing out of his house super fast, and there's not. He could have sold that for some pretty good money, Joe. Go ahead.
WS2N. I don't know. I didn't know the guy was even looking at astronomy. I have no idea. He's more interested in shooting golf balls on his lawn. So maybe he has one interest that comes and goes and wanes and. This is in his garage. He's obviously cleaning out his garage because he's having work or paint done in his garage. He put a whole bunch of stuff out to the curb today, and that was when I saw it. I went out there immediately, grabbed it. It was gone. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Joe. And if you've ever listened to Craig on the astronomy, that he knows more about telescopes than I've ever heard in my life. Incredible. In fact, I got one, Celestron. And there was something wrong with it. I described the problem to him, and he pretty much told me, you know, you can bring it back, or you go through this whole process of recollimating it with lasers and this. So, you know, it was new, so I just sent it back. But he knows. I mean, you can tell him any telescope, and I bet he'll tell you everything. He'll tell you the year was made, how much it's worth, somebody probably paid for it. You know what I mean, Joe? Get on his net.
Well, in one closing comment, Dick, now that I have something that can see something in the sky better than just a pair of binoculars, I'll actually take a look at those stars, one, two, or three of them I've seen, that have different colorations in them when viewed through a pair of binoculars. Now I'm going to get to see that through a telescope and actually see what I'm really seeing. Back to you.
Yeah, the very next thing I would do is look up the serial number, the model number, which is printed on it, and go to the MEAD website and download that owner's manual. You will get that owner's manual free of charge. That will tell you everything you want to know. And because it's an American company, you'll have no trouble reading the owner's manual. It's not written in Chinglish, if you know what I mean, Chinese English. So That will answer all of your questions as to what that motorized function does. And that sounds like an awful lot of telescope. And you can also go to eBay or any of these other places and find out what that exact model is selling for, used. And I think you're going to be very pleased. So good luck with that project and let us know what you find out. The very next person on our list was Bob number one, KA2 Golf Echo Foxtrot. Sorry to keep you waiting, Bob. Go right ahead. K2RIW and TechNet. Wait for the beeps.
Good evening, Dick. KA2GEF here. Alright, I have a short question. I'm setting up a satellite antenna system. I'm transmitting, I want to transmit on UHF and receive on VHF. There's a lot of FM satellites I've run across that use that combination. UHF in and VHF out, they transmit. Now, I have a 10 dB gain UHF antenna. I also have a 9 dB gain VHF antenna. How do I determine? Oh, and the other thing I have to do, I have a ICOM 706 mobile unit, and that's what's going to be used to split between the VHF and the UHF. Let me drop it for a second. Okay. Now, what I wanted, I also have to use a Inritsu splitter, because my 706, everything is on one cable. So, going from the radio to the antennas, I have a half inch hard line, and then go to a splitter, one side UHF, one side VHF. And what's the distance between the boom, between the two antennas? And if I want to talk on sideband, do I have to tilt the antenna 45 degrees to get that circular polarization? Back to you, Dick.
Tilting the antenna does not create circular polarization. The satellite itself, you can assume it's rotating. The satellite is putting out, most of the satellites, I think, are transmitting circular polarization. So, is that true? You'll have to check on that particular satellite that you're lining yourself up on. Some of them, I think, are linear. Some of them are circular. Your 706 can transmit VHF, listen on UHF, independently. I mean, one at a time, simplex. Although it's not mandatory, it would be awful nice if you could transmit on UHF and listen on VHF simultaneously. You'd like to know how strong you're coming through the machine, the satellite. How strong are you in the uplink? How strong are you in the downlink? How well are you getting through? So if you could borrow somebody else's VHF sideband receiver, so you could use it separately while transmitting UHF for the uplink, there's a great advantage of doing that. Let me drop. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just want to point out something. If you're going to work on a satellite that's got a linear transponder, okay, it's not an FM satellite. You can saturate them all you want. You will get yelled at if you can't hear yourself, because if you saturate a linear transponder, you wipe it out for everybody else. So you got to watch it. And besides, when you're working with a linear transponder, because of the Doppler shift, it's constantly moving, and it's moving in the opposite directions. So, don't forget, what goes in gets inverted when it comes out. K2RW, K2J.
The inversion that Eric was discussing is that if you take the uplink frequency and spin the dial to go to a higher frequency, most of the time, the satellite in mode number two is set up so that the downlink on VHF will move down, so that you move the uplink frequency up and the downlink frequency will move down. They move apart, so to speak, if you had one common dial between the two. So for a bunch of reasons, you're going to wish you had a separate transmitter and separate receiver so you could run them simultaneously and hear what's coming back down. In the case of a single sideband satellite, which by definition means linear, there's a specific amount of power you put into the uplink so that you have a good enough signal-to-noise ratio without being too strong and saturating it. If you're the guy that saturates it, you'll make yourself very unpopular with all the other people that want to use it. If it's a, let me drop. If it's an FM satellite, you don't have that problem. So, for a bunch of reasons, you're going to want a separate transmitter and receiver so you can listen to what's coming back down. You're going to also want to have an antenna that is steerable. With rare exception, the downlink is limited. In other words, you're going to have as much gain as you've got aimed as precisely as possible at the satellite as it moves across the sky. You're going to track the satellite so that all the gain of your downlink VHF antenna can have all the possible signal-to-noise ratio with a good preamp in the front end, because most satellites, the downlink signal is weak and you need all the gain properly aimed on the ground in order to get it. The VHF and UHF antenna, the distance between them, you'd be amazed how close they can be. You choose the right design of antenna. The VHF element and the UHF element can be on the same boom of that Yagi on certain designs. That's some of the information you're looking for. And by the way, you don't have a brief question, Bob. There's a whole lot of things that you need to know. KA2GEF, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
By the way, you don't want to use a metal boom at holding on to both of those antennas.
Give me some feedback on that one, Eric. What are you saying?
All the satellite systems that I put together actually use a fiberglass boom. And it actually really does help in terms of desensing. I mean, you can use a metal boom, but I've done both, and you get far better results by using an insulated boom.
You may have observed that effect, Eric, but it's opposite of everything I know about Yagis. The individual elements of VHF Yagi and UHF Yagi are on the same metallic boom. The amount of cross coupling really occurs primarily at the driven element. The driven element on UHF are inches apart, and there's a huge amount of cross coupling. So you'll have some damn good filtering so that the UHF is not coming into the VHF input and desensing that receiver. That's where the isolation really comes from. The presence of the boom is not changing the harmonics, so to speak, that are creating descents that will get by your filter. If you've got the right kind of a filter, what's wrong with a metal boom? I'm very curious about that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW.
I probably can't give you a really good explanation, but I will tell you this. Okay, if you happen to be using like a A2FT 736 or the equivalent ICOM as it's designed, or even an 857, 857 or 847, that's both, most of those receivers are designed for satellite work. They will actually tune in opposite directions depending upon what kind of a transponder you're going through. I have put together, actually at first, you've seen my antenna when I was in Victoria, and that had the fiberglass boom in between. And on those radios, it makes a difference. Why? Can't tell you. But I do know from experience that you do get a much better result with the non-metallic boom in between. Not that it's electrically conductive, I think it's magnetically conductive. But that's just a guess on my part.
Yeah, from my point of view, that's a strange observation, Eric. Now, do any of those radios that you said are intended for satellite work, do they have full duplex capability? Can they transmit on the uplink on UHF and listen simultaneously on the...
Absolutely.
Okay. Can the 706 do that?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so there is a brand name of radio and model number that is intended for satellite service that'll do that. And so, in Bob's case, maybe he's going to have to borrow somebody else's 2-meter transmitter or 450 transmitter, whichever one he wants to substitute. So he's got two completely separate rigs for the time being, but he doesn't have a fully satellite-rated radio. Because I think he's going to want to listen to that downlink while he's transmitting to the uplink. To do it in the blind, I think, would be 3 times more difficult. You might have an opinion on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. All years that I've been on satellites, it's been an interesting experience. One thing I will say is that when you have two separate radios and two separate power supplies that aren't connected to each other, they seem to work a little bit differently than the radios that have it built in. I think there's, I don't know what it is about it. There's something I never really investigated. I've always had really good results with the 736, which I still have, and the 847. But I've done it with separate transmitters and receivers. Unless you have it hooked up to a computer that knows what you're doing, it gets a little bit difficult to operate. That's the nice part about the radios designed for satellites. They tune in the proper direction according to what satellite type of satellite transponder you're working on. Well, let me let it drop. There's one important thing I got to say. When working through an FM transponder, not really a transponder, just they don't take it to IF, they actually take it to audio and back up. You don't really have to listen to yourself. Because you have the AFC in the radio itself, it will follow it to a certain degree before you have to start twisting it up. If you go see a demonstration like it to any of the big hand tests like Dayton, things like that, you'll see somebody with a two-handy talkie connected to two antennas on a common boom, just pointing the thing up manually and making contact. So the difference is you don't have to go through all that trouble with FM. You can be real sloppy about it. But if you're going to do sideband, you're going to go through it winning a transponder, you're going to send slow scan or something like that, you better damn well know what you're doing or you're going to make enemies.
So you didn't say it, but you implied it. When you're going through a linear transmitter that's got sideband capability, you better have full duplex. You better be able to hear your downlink when you're transmitting the uplink so you can know what's going on. Whereas with these FM more forgiving systems, you don't necessarily need full duplex. Is that somewhat true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. But when you see the demonstrations, you'll see them using two separate HTs, and they'll be listening at the same time they're transmitting. But you don't have to.
And to reiterate one of the questions you asked, Bob, is how close can you mount the two antennas? Under certain conditions, you can make, if you have a UHF Yagi and a VHF Yagi, you might be able to literally move them so close together that you put hose clamps around the two booms, and the two booms are slapped up against each other. You might be able to do that, and I'm not kidding. KA2GEF, K2RIW, go ahead, Bob.
By the way, they sell antennas which have both UHF and VHF on the same boom, and they work just fine.
And that's a metal boom in many cases. Over to you, Jeff. Over to you, Bob.
Okay, wow. A lot of information there. The you're talking about, Eric, is the arrow antenna. Yeah, I've seen that. But I just happen to have three Yagis for UHF in my shed, and I just purchased the VHF a couple of weeks ago, so I think I'm going to go with that, and I might try transmitting on the FM satellite with my 2017 HT and receiving on the 706. I can do that. That wouldn't be a problem. Is that a good idea?
These guys that you've seen that demonstration of, Eric, with a handy talkie on the uplink and a handy talkie on the downlink, they must have been using a rather good antenna, because many of these satellites are downlink limited, and you need more than 5 watts in the uplink. Over to you, Eric, KE2EJ.